Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. For the past few decades, Dennis Lehane has been one of the most influential and prolific authors of crime fiction. The Bard of Boston, as I just this moment dubbed him, is probably best known for his bestsellers like Mystic River, Shutter Island, and Gone Baby Gone. He also served as a writer for The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, and Black Bird. Lehane's latest Southie saga is the novel Small Mercies. It's set at the tail end of summer in 1974 during the Boston busing riots. This forced school desegregation led to violent and racist protests. Caught up directly in this upheaval is Lehane's tough-as-nails protagonist, Mary Pat Fennessy. Mary Pat's daughter goes missing the same night a black man is killed in a white Boston neighborhood. At first, the two seem unconnected. Then, Mary Pat's journey for the truth leads her to some dark realities about both crimes. As he's done in his past work, Lehane ratchets up the tension and explores a racially sensitive time in American history. Dennis joins us to talk about living through the busing riots himself and why he wanted to center the story around a single mother from the Southie Projects.
She was inspired by several women I knew growing up, both from the housing projects in South Boston and the poorer sections of Dorchester, where I grew up. These were women who literally could go toe-to-toe in a fistfight with a man. They might not win, but they would certainly hold their own for a little bit. They were all chain smokers. They were all foul-mouthed. They were all functioning alcoholics. And as time went on, I began to realize that these types of women had an inherent sadness at their core, that you don't get to be that tough unless your life is that tough, unless poverty's been grinding you down, unless there's significant abuse, whether it's from a husband or from a father. I wanted to pay tribute to that type of person and also to not gloss over what would have been her negative qualities. I would have found it almost impossible to believe that Mary Pat wasn't a racist. And so I start the book with her in a bit of denial about it, but that's the journey of the book, is she comes to understand how pervasive her racism is and how she passed it down as a destructive legacy to the people who she loves.
Yeah, she's a fascinating character and very, very fleshed out, very, very multidimensional. She's a very intriguing character. You set Small Mercies in 1974 against the Boston busing riots. Why did you want to investigate this era?
Because I was 9 when it happened and I had a front row seat for all of it. It was a pretty cataclysmic event in the life of the city and in my life as a kid. And it brought up all sorts of unanswerable questions about people. Here you are, and you're looking at somebody who you admire, you like, maybe you love, and they're good people with good hearts. And yet then what this event did was scratch at a part of them, which was a virulent, virulent racism that you might not have been privy to otherwise. And once it came out of the box, it wasn't going back in for a very long time. And it felt as if, how could you align somebody who was okay with people who threw rocks at buses filled with children? I mean, they might not say, hey, I'd do it, but they were okay with it. And casually or vehemently use the N-word. How can you align that with somebody who you care about? How can you make sense of that when you're 9 years old? Maybe some 9-year-olds can, but I sure couldn't.
Yeah. How long did it take you? How old were you when you finally were able to make sense of it?
This book, maybe? Yeah, it took a very long time. It took a long time to understand that that was a source of rage at the center of me, because I could never understand, you know, outside of having, you know, a classic Irish temper, where I had a wellspring of anger in me. And it certainly wasn't from my parents, who were quite loving and protective. And it wasn't from any trauma in my childhood that I could point to. But then when I started to write this book, I began to go, oh my God, I'm really angry. Mm-hmm. I'm extremely angry for that kid, for that 9-year-old, and for a lot of other 9-year-olds, and for a bunch of 15-year-olds and a bunch of 16-year-olds and who got their, you know, got their futures taken from them by this boycott. You know, when the boycott started, it went on for quite some time, and it became a like an assembly line for low-level soldiers for Whitey Bulger and the Winter Hill Gang. And there's, you know, there's whole futures, many whole futures were just wiped out.
How did you approach weaving this historical timeline, this boycott? How did you approach weaving that into your plot?
It was reasonably simple. It's nice to have a box. And I knew what my box was. My box ended on September 12th. So wherever I chose to start the novel, I chose to start it very close to the September 12th. I don't know the exact date, but I believe it begins around August 28th. Mm-hmm. And the first day of school, a first day of school unlike any other in this history of the city, is looming. And it's about to affect this woman and her daughter. And her daughter is the only person she has left in the world. When that daughter goes missing, the same night that an African-American man is killed in a subway station, that sets the clock on the book. From that point on, everything's ticking very hard, very loud.
Yeah. There are a lot of echoes of your past work in Small Mercies, but this book seems to confront the racial tensions and attitudes of Boston much more overtly. How did you approach this?
This book flowed out of me. It was a very pleasant experience to write. That's hard to believe because it's such a brutal book, but it did feel like purging something. And it did feel like I was aware that maybe people would try to push back and rewrite history with this book and say it wasn't like that, it's being over-dramatized, whatever. So I sourced everything. I looked at everything as I wrote it. I looked at a lot of photographs, particularly by this guy, Eugene Richards. It's a Eugene Richards photograph on the front of the book. And he was the sort of war photographer of the busing crisis. He took everything, he took so many pictures. Hmm. And there's no hiding from what he shot. There's no hiding from it. The graffiti, the signs in the windows, it was horrific. And then tied into this was the other issue, which was you had several neighborhoods throughout the city that were working class neighborhoods. And they were very frustrated with constantly being told, hey, we're going to drop the highway in through your neighborhood. Hey, we're going to urban renewal your neighborhood. These things were not affecting the wealthy suburbs. So when they decided to do this and the suburbs pulled out at the 11th hour and it became simply an inner city issue and a working class issue, there were people who were legitimately outraged, who weren't racists. And, you know, my father was one of them. And I feel like that, unfortunately, what happened was that that legitimate dismay, if you will, or a legitimate discussion that could have been had about that issue was completely overshadowed by the vehemence and the virulence of the racism. And so the debate never happened. And so it became just a situation of, here go those dumb poor again, you know, yeah, beating each other up. That's it.
Yeah. The concept of community runs throughout Small Mercies. It's this hardscrabble neighborhood where the best childhood friends can make the worst enemies. What is it about this idea that your neighbors can be saviors or threats that resonates with you?
Well, I think I write about tribalism. I think I've been writing about tribalism consistently since my first book. In tribalism, when it exists to survive, is a good thing. It's every immigrant culture does it. You know, if you look at it, you know, what is Chinatown? But, you know, tribalism. Each immigrant culture will kind of do a daisy chain back to the original country and pull people over, and they'll set up their communities tightly knit in an area. But when tribalism continues past the point of its usefulness, once that tribe is kind of safe and entrenched, then it becomes a very ugly thing. And the ugly aspects of it are what I explore in this book, I think, more than any other book I wrote.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but what you just said, yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah. I think it was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross where you said that you develop books through a single character or a single line of prose. In fact, one of the lines in Mystic River was based on this, wasn't it? The line was, it occurred to him as he was shaving that he was evil.
Yeah, I drove the whole book towards that line.
Did you have a similar line that inspired Small Mercies?
No, I really didn't. With Small Mercies, I just had her. Mm. I had her. And then Bobby showed up, and he wasn't supposed to stay in the book, and then he stuck around. And that allowed me to leaven the darkness with some light and some hope, and to give it another perspective, which I think was necessary. The book was growing claustrophobic. But Mary Pat to me was, I just saw this dynamo in my head. I had this picture of her as a, and she's even described as, you know, she came out of the womb looking like she was auditioning for the roller derby.
Yeah.
And that's how I saw her. I saw her very much as this small, squat, low to the ground force of nature coming at you as fast as possible. And she will not stop until she finds out what she needs to find out. Until she affects some type of justice, this woman will not stop. And knowing that going into the book, really just, it made it a really wonderful experience, because all I just said was I lit the match, I lit the fuse, I let Mary Pat off and running, and then I just said, you know, we're going to take this all the way to the end.
Yeah. You mentioned Bobby, the detective Bobby Coyne. He's another very compelling character. Can you tell us a bit about him?
We meet him early, and he's the detective looking into the death of the African-American man, Augie Williamson. He's clearly from the neighborhood. Mary Pat picks up a quick affinity with him because of that, and also because he served in Vietnam, as did her son. And her son died of a heroin overdose after coming back from Vietnam. And Bobby's secret is that he got addicted to heroin over in Vietnam and is in rehab. And there's a gentleness to him that really surprised me. He's consistently described as having a rough face and a gentle voice. And I just love this idea of this courtly gentleman in the midst of all this kind of carnage, whether that be Vietnam or Boston during 1974. And I liked him. And then I got to do something I've been trying to do for years, which is his family situation. He lives with his sisters and one brother. Mm-hmm. And they all live in this, and they're all heading to middle age. And they have one child between them, who's Bobby's, who comes on weekends. And that's actually based on a family I knew growing up. And I've always wanted to pay tribute to that house because I found it a wonderfully warm and kind of iconoclastic place. And that's what I paid tribute to with Bobby's life. And then during the course of the book, he even falls in love. I mean, a lot of good things happen for Bobby.
Yeah, and he deserves them. Yeah. You specialize in creating memorable lines in your writing. I'd like to ask you about a couple, if you don't mind.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, you were one of the writers for HBO's The Wire, and I believe responsible for one of the best lines of the series, the scene when drug kingpin Marlowe says, "You want it to be one way, but it's the other way." Was that a Dennis Lehane line?
That's a Dennis Lehane line, yeah. Yeah.
It's a good one. Do you remember? Yeah. Do you remember how you came up with that line?
I had put it in, it was actually in a short story I wrote. And a very Kafka-esque short story I once wrote called ICU. I wrote it, and then all of a sudden I was like, we were always cobbling stuff from our own stuff for The Wire. It was kind of it all started because they did a tribute to a scene in Richard Price's book, Clockers. And Richard was one of the writers on the show. And so we just began to like crib from our own work all the time. So I took that line. I'm trying to think the other great line. I think the other great Wire line I had was the one I'm proud of was, a lie isn't a side of a story. It's just a lie.
That's good too. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know that the Marlowe line is legendary in Wire fandom, especially in the Wire subreddit on Reddit?
I did not know that. Yeah. People have brought it up to me a lot. So, you know, at least there's that. That's nice to hear.
Yeah. Another single line that packs a punch is from the movie The Drop, which you wrote. Do you know which line I'm talking about?
Nobody ever sees you coming?
Exactly. No one ever sees you coming, do they, Bob? Yeah, very good. So much of your work gets adapted for TV and film. I have to ask, is Small Mercies going to end up on a screen someday?
Yes. But it's mine. I'm running the show. So,
oh, nice.
I've already cut the deal with Apple TV.
Fantastic.
Current employer, and we shall be getting into it very soon once I get through the first season of the next show I'm doing for them.
Great. Looking forward to that. You're so busy these days as a TV writer and showrunner. There's been talk that Small Mercies could be your last novel. Will it be?
No, I can't say whether it will or won't. Okay. I can say it could be because I'm not under contract anymore, and for the first time in 25 years. So I don't owe anybody anything. I don't owe money on an advance. I'm not owing a book on deadline. I owe nothing. And so what happened with Small Mercies that was wonderful was Small Mercies came out of the place my earliest work did, which was a very pure place of, I need to tell this story. It has to come out. And that's where I always want to write novels from this point forward. So mm-hmm. if I need to write another novel, if I feel it possess me, then I'm going right in and writing a novel because I love writing novels. But if I don't, and I'm just going to continue making fun quality television, then that's what I'll do too.
All right. Sounds good. We're set either way. Dennis Lehane, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Small Mercies. It's vintage Lehane.
Thank you so much.
Dennis Lehane is the author of the novel Small Mercies. You can find out more about Dennis and his book at wpr.org/beta.
There's something to his movies that's more than just a throwaway disposable entertainment, if there is such a thing. And that's what I think makes Americans uncomfortable anyway.
Coming up, film critic Walter Chow returns to Wax Cinematic about director Walter Hill's 1979 movie, The Warriors. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.